evening, I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. According to the United Nations, 122 million children their lives have been saved since 1990. So the United Nations says 122 million children's lives have been saved since 1990. And analysts say some progress have been made, not only in children's health, but also in other aspects of global development, including women's health. In their annual letter released recently, philanthropist Bill and Melinda Gates highlight gains made in global development, including a mother's well-being and education. And they also address some remaining challenges. I spoke to Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, in an exclusive interview with The Voice of America, and I asked her for her reaction on the global progress made in global development.
Well, the progress is really astounding, and it's the progress that the world has made. And so it makes me even more optimistic about what we can do in the future, because not only has this progress been made about lives saved, about people lifted out of poverty, but it's accelerating now, particularly in the last 5 years. So there is so much more that can be done.
And one of the examples is the number of childhood deaths per year has been cut in half, according to the United Nations, since 1990, and 122 million have been saved. These numbers are really, really encouraging.
They are absolutely encouraging, and it's the great thing now is we have even more data. We know what has saved those children's lives. It's been predominantly malarial bed nets and vaccines, but we're seeing the number of children's deaths go down, and we're also seeing that, okay, the deaths that are still left are particularly these newborn lives, these first 30 days. A million kids die on the first day of life. And so we also know now, okay, this is where we also need to act.
So how do we act?
We get more data. And so one of the things that we point out in the annual letter is that parents in Africa are letting us actually do now very thoughtfully these minimally invasive autopsies, and it allows them to understand what did their child actually die from. And then they let us use that information, that data, so that we can understand what lots of kids die from, and then put great tools behind that. And that's actually really exciting.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has played an important role in global development and improving health. What did it take to achieve this gain in children's health in particular? I know you touched on it. You gave us a sense of what it took. But if you could elaborate a little more from the foundation's perspective.
Sure. Well, first of all, the foundation does all the work that we do is with partners all over the world. There's nothing we do without a partner being involved. And the other great thing is that the United Nations set before these Millennium Development Goals. They're now the Sustainable Development Goals. But it gave a roadmap, a blueprint to the world of how should we tackle death and disability around the world. And so one of the things that the foundation focused on with our many partners was on these childhood deaths. And a lot of new vaccines came out, particularly around pneumonia deaths and diarrheal deaths. Those are the two biggest killers of children still around the world. We needed new vaccines that didn't exist for those. Those vaccines now not only exist, but they're being delivered all over the world in some of the most remote rural places in Kenya and India and Tanzania. Parents are accepting them. The vaccination rate is up to 86% now around the world. We need to get that, honestly, to 100%, but parents are seeing the benefit of that. And parents are also choosing to get a malarial bed net because governments are now giving them out all over Africa. And they're not only getting them, they're actually sleeping under them because they see the benefits for themselves and their children of fewer malarial episodes in their households.
And you mentioned vaccine. Would you elaborate on how investing in childhood immunization is not just good for the child's health, but also beneficial to the economy? Because that's something that a lot of people are really struggling with to understand.
If a child grows up healthy, and then they have their greatest potential of being educated and going on to get a job and producing economic means for their own family. And ultimately, if they lift up their family, they're lifting up their community and they're lifting up a whole economy. So we call that the demographic dividend. That is, if you get a healthy population of kids that get educated and then get into their productive working years late in their teenage years, literally you see gains in your economy overall. But they have to start healthy in life, which is why vaccines are so important, why getting fewer malarial episodes is important, why getting the right nutrition is important so that they can grow and reach the potential they have, both cognitively and developmentally.
You talked about the demographic dividend. It was on the agenda actually recently during the Africa Union Summit. It is really something that seems to attract a lot of attention these days. Why do you think it is so?
I think it's attracting attention because we're seeing that countries who have lifted themselves out of poverty, countries that have moved all over the world from low-income to middle-income countries and ultimately high-income countries, certain steps in progress had to happen. One of those steps is that the children have to grow up healthy. Another step is that the children's births have to be spaced. Women have to be able to space the births of their children. Ideally, if they can space them 3 years, then those children have a better chance of a start in life. The children grow up healthier, and the mom is healthier. And that means if the mom's healthier, she can bring in more income to feed the kids. She can get her kids in school. Moms are and dads are very interested in getting their kids educated so they can participate and bring in income for the family. And what's happening now is finance ministers and presidents and prime ministers are looking at the development that happened around the world, like a country like South Korea, and saying, we want to learn those lessons of health, those lessons of agriculture, those lessons of birth spacing, so that our population has the best chance to grow up healthy and for us to be a middle-income country.
And birth spacing takes us to the issue of contraceptives. What is your assessment of how this is being tackled on the continent?
Well, for the first time in history, there are 300 million women in developing countries on contraceptives. We've never had that before. Now, there's a global goal to get 120 million women voluntary access to contraceptives by the year 2020. And so the right groundwork is being laid for that. That is, governments are looking at their supply chain issues and saying, okay, do we have, you know, all the tools that a woman might want, whether it's a long-acting tool or a short-acting contraceptive? Have we fixed the supply chain so that contraceptives are not just in the capital city but out in the remote rural areas? Are we making sure we have the right policies so that, you know, the newer tools that have come along that are easier to use and have fewer side effects, women have access? And lastly, are we doing the cultural piece to educate men and women and even the religious leaders of why contraceptives actually make healthier families? And so I'm seeing countries take all of those steps. It's taking some time. Different countries are further ahead in different pieces of that, but I'm very encouraged by the groundwork that's being laid.
How do you think that men can be part of the solution when it comes to addressing the issue of contraceptives? Because as you mentioned, in some settings, men are very, very reluctant to see their women use it.
Right. So what we're seeing is that the men will buy into the idea of contraceptives when they understand that their children will be healthier. If you say to a man, you know, that your child will grow up healthier and have a better chance of being educated if your wife is able to space the birth by 3 years, we know that your child is 35% more likely to make it to their first birthday if the spacing has been by 3 years, and twice as likely to make it to their fifth birthday. Most dads that I have met all over the world are interested in having healthy children. Yeah. We also talk to them about the fact that their wife will be healthier. And again, we know from great studies that if those births are spaced, the family is ultimately wealthier. And so when men start to understand that, why that spacing is so important and so beneficial, then they start to buy in. But again, you have to talk to them in ways that are interesting and understandable to them, and that has to be done in the right cultural context, which is different in different countries in Africa.
Absolutely. And that was Melinda Gates, part one of our interview. We'll have part two of my exclusive interview with Melinda Gates in a moment. It's time for a short break. And first, we have the news with Hedy Adams-Fitzpatrick.
Good evening. Here is your latest in health news. Time is running out for more than a million children who are at risk of death from acute malnutrition this year. That's the warning from UNICEF. It comes as famine looms in Nigeria, Somalia, South Sudan and Yemen. The drought conditions in Somalia are threatening an already fragile population battered by decades of conflict. In South Sudan, more than 270,000 children are severely malnourished. UNICEF's executive director, Anthony Lake, says many lives can be saved because famine and malnutrition are man-made. He's calling for faster global action, saying the tragedy of the 2011 famine in the Horn of Africa should not be repeated. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning tonight that about 2 million refugees across Africa are facing critical shortages in food assistance. Refugee operations across 10 African countries are being cut, and that's affecting the amount and quality of food for millions of people. Food rations have been dramatically reduced, in some cases by up to 50% in large operations. Those include Cameroon, Chad, Kenya, Mauritania, South Sudan and Uganda. Moving to Europe now, and doctors in the UK say a multiple sclerosis treatment is being tested in patients and it has the potential to stop the disease for at least 5 years. Doctors say the therapy is high risk, so only some patients will be suitable to try it. The therapy involves wiping out the patient's immune system with strong cancer drugs and then rebooting it with a stem cell transplant. Out of the 281 people who had the treatment, nearly half benefited, but 8 died shortly afterwards. MS is not fatal, but it is incurable. The disease causes the immune system to attack the protective coating of nerves in the brain and spinal cord, which creates problems with vision, walking, and balance. And that is your latest health news. I'm Hayley Adams-Fitzpatrick. Here's Lenore.
Thank you, Adi. Welcome back. For those of you joining us late tonight, we have my exclusive interview with Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We'll have part two of the discussion, but first, VOA's Rahel Obor has this report on Kenya home birth.
Kenya had one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world, 488 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births, according to the Ministry of Health. The most common causes of maternal death in Kenya are hypertension and hemorrhage. Prenatal care and giving birth in unequipped medical facilities are key to reversing that trend. So Kenya made prenatal care and childbirth free in public hospitals nationwide. Jacinta Omoro has had 3 children. She says she escaped death by a whisker, delivering her second baby at a home in Nairobi's Kibera slum.
Firstborn yangu, nilienda niliza kwa mkunga.
My firstborn, I went to a birth attendant. Everything went well, she says. For my second baby, I also went to the same birth attendant. I gave birth, but I bled a lot, she continues. For the third baby, I decided to go to hospital and for clinics. When I went to hospitals, I saw a very big difference. I honestly think it's the safest, she concludes. Not all women have had the same experience. 4 women are seated inside a house in Kibera. Among them is Mama Atoti, a local midwife. She delivered the babies of the other 3 women, but that was before 2013. Now, Benta Amolo is pregnant again, and she is back. Benta Amolo tells Atoti that the doctor sent her for a scan to see the baby's position, and she is worried. Her pregnancy is almost at term. The other women nod and share stories. One says she had a safe delivery at a hospital in 2014, but the doctors there scared her. Benta Amolo says the doctor told her to prepare to face the knife, this time because a baby is breech, so she came to Mama Atoti. The room goes silent as Atoti asks her to lie on the bed. She then uses her hands on Amolo's belly to turn the baby to a head-down position, a procedure known as external cephalic version. This procedure is considered risky. In some countries, it is only performed at a hospital with fetal monitoring in case the umbilical cord is compromised, something that can immediately endanger the life of the baby. Doctors in Kenya don't perform the procedure. When a baby is breached, they schedule a cesarean section, a surgical procedure to remove the baby at term, arguing that it is safer. Obstetrician Dr. Andrew Toro says he knows some women still feel more comfortable with traditional birth attendants.
Some people who have come to hospital, we have probably experienced the rude staff, either because of a misunderstanding or maybe because of emotional or physical burnout. So we are also trying to educate our staff to be kind and courteous, because you know we sometimes can stigmatize the hospital by offering a bad care because of poor relations.
The Ministry of Health says since the introduction of free maternal care in 2013, public hospitals have reported a 50% increase in deliveries. The question is, were they ready for such a rapid influx of patients? The ministry's four-year strategy report released in 2014 indicates that they were not. The report points to the urgent need to fill a staffing gap in doctors and nurses in public hospitals by 2030. Women who visit Mama Atoti say they prefer her bedside manner. She tells us she has been doing this for 36 years and has delivered over 3,000 babies.
Wabem blessa ji, mangano nyol maber, magonina santi, modhi mucha koduogi.
She says community midwives pamper and take care of women during and after delivery. She says we help them give birth with dignity. She says that this is why women come back to her when they're having another baby. But there have been close calls. She has had women brought to her in the middle of the night, already bleeding profusely. She says she sends them immediately to the nearby hospital. She also refers HIV-positive women to the hospital, but she says she knows not all women disclose their status to her. She says it's a constant risk. Rael Umbor for VOA News, Nairobi.
And welcome back. If you're just joining us today, we have our exclusive interview with Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Here's part two of my interview. Now, there is a saying that a healthy baby starts with a healthy mother. Is this why women's health is so important to you as well?
Absolutely. So we know that if a child is, for instance, fed properly in what we call their first 1,000 days of life, which actually means at the start of conception, all the way through the pregnancy, so the mom being fed properly and then the child being fed properly, it means that that child can grow up to reach their full potential, both cognitively and developmentally. Bill and I believe that every child in the world should have the chance at a healthy start and a chance to lead a life that leads to their full potential. I think that is what we should aspire for all children. I think it's what parents dream of for their children. And so that's what we're trying to provide.
And in 2015, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation introduced the Child Health and Mortality Prevention Surveillance Network, CHAMPS, a network of disease surveillance sites in developing countries. What impact have you seen through this initiative?
CHAMPS, this surveillance site that you're mentioning, what we're seeing is a network now where we can get far more information, and information that then the global health community can act upon. So, for instance, the fact that talking with parents who have lost a newborn, you know, over 40% of the childhood deaths now are of newborns, you know, so with that first 30 days, and a million deaths happen on the very first day of life. So by talking with parents who've lost a newborn, which is a very tragic event for them and for their family, but saying we can learn something from it, you can learn what your child died of, and science can learn then something from that as well that will help other children. We're finding more and more parents are interested in that. They want to know what their child died of. And by collecting that information, that data, we will start to understand what those million children die of on that first day of life and how we can save those babies in the future. And so that CHAMPS, that surveillance network, that's one of the things that they will help us with in learning.
And what other innovative ways used in Africa by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have been adapted to drive progress in child's health?
We're seeing unbelievable progress across the continent in Africa. We're seeing governments interested in making sure that their children are vaccinated and vaccinated properly. We're seeing governments start to make the right investments in the primary health care centers. There are some shining examples like Ethiopia or like Rwanda, where they have a whole development plan for their country. South Africa is another good one. And they'll say, okay, we know that the first place a mom or dad comes with a sick child is that primary health care clinic, that tiny little clinic. We need to make sure that they're staffed appropriately, often with a few health care workers who are trained, and that they have the right supplies. So we're starting to see those investments happen not just in a few countries, but at scale in Africa, because African countries are learning from one another. We're seeing Africa has really tackled malaria. One of the reasons that the childhood death numbers are down so significantly is both vaccines and malarial bed nets. And we're starting to see a lot of the right development things happen in a number of countries. For instance, mobile banking is totally at scale in Kenya and Tanzania. And that means if you're a poor family in a remote rural place, you can actually save a dollar a day. So when the hunger season comes, you have money to go buy food at market and feed your kids. Or when the school fees come due, you've actually saved that money over the course of the year. So we're seeing tremendous progress in different places across the continent. And it's really, I think the thing Bill and I are so encouraged about is these African countries are development partners. Mm-hmm. They're partnering with other organizations around the world, and they're learning from one another on the continent. And I think that is really going to be beneficial across the continent over the next 20 years.
So moving forward, what are some of the key issues that will be on top of the agenda for the foundation, especially with childhood health?
Well, you're going to see us continue to make investments and maybe more investments in nutrition, because as I mentioned, that first 1,000-day window is so important that if a child doesn't grow up healthy, they don't have the chance to reach their full cognitive and developmental potential. Some more investments have to be made in that area, even quite honestly on the research agenda, because we're learning that different children's guts, depending on where they grow up and what their immune system is facing in those first few years of life, is very different in a country like Uganda versus Kenya versus South Africa. So we don't even understand as a world enough about a child's gut to understand exactly what interventions we should make. Should we give them more zinc? Should we give them more vitamin A, more vitamin D? So until that research agenda gets completed and filled out, or filling it out will help us understand how to make the most key investments. So you'll see us really investing in that research agenda. You'll see us continuing on vaccines and really looking at this first 30 days of life of what else we can do to save so many children that die in those first 30 days.
Let's come back to women's health. You have a particular interest in women and girls, we see in your work. Some people say that women have come a long way around the world economically and socially. One example is when we look at the MDGs, the literacy rate has improved globally from 83% to 91% between 1990 and 2015. And the gap between women and men has narrowed among youth aged 15 to 24. What do you make of this progress? How do you assess the status of women and girls, particularly in Africa?
Well, I would say that we, women and girls, we are absolutely making progress. The statistics that you just cited are right. They are there. I think we need to accelerate that progress. We need to intensify it, and we need to accelerate it. There is not yet parity for women in any country around the world, including my own. And until we reach parity on everything, we are not there yet. So I think continuing to make investments on behalf of women, making sure in particular in some African countries, despite the statistics getting better, they're absolutely better at the primary level. And as you pointed out, they're getting better at the secondary level. But there are still many places where a girl is pulled out of school early and she doesn't actually get to complete secondary school. And a quality education is incredibly important to everything we're discussing. If a girl or a boy doesn't have a quality education, they don't have the chance to go on to university if that's their dream. So we need to continue to make those investments on behalf of both boys and girls and to do it equally.
You spoke about lack of parity. The SDG 5 aims at achieving gender equality and empowering all women and girls by 2030. Is this a realistic goal? How can we make sustainable progress within the next decade?
Well, we need to keep making the investments that we are making on behalf of women and girls. We need to look at where they're being held back. We need to look at where we need to invest more in their health. For instance, HIV/AIDS predominantly hits women in the 15 to 24 age cohort. That is a really important time in a young woman's life. So we need to make the investments in HIV/AIDS there. We need to make the investments in HPV, which is the vaccine on cervical cancer. So we have to make investments in women's health. We have to make investments in making sure they have a quality education, that they're kept in school, And we need to make sure that they have economic opportunity. If we do those things, women will have the chance to reach their full potential. But that's a substantial agenda between now and 2030, and one that, you know, development partners and governments really need to tackle head on and take on those various pieces.
Mrs. Melinda Gates, great. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Lenore. I'm glad we got this time to talk.
And that was Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, speaking exclusively to The Voice of America. Now let's go to South Sudan, where VOA's Ayen Bio takes a look at what is being done in family planning in the country.
Senan Hunton, senior technical advisor for the UN's Population Fund in Juba, says one way to lower maternal or infant mortality rates is to help women consider the benefits of family planning, which is a practice of controlling the number of children they have and lengthening the pauses between childbirths.
Because just by spacing delivery, we can reduce by 30% the risk of maternal death. We can reduce by another 10% the risk of losing a child. And so this is very critically important, especially for a young nation like South Sudan, about social economic transformation and survival. So having said that, yes, we have a social barrier in the use of family planning in South Sudan. But this is not particular to South Sudan.
Only about 1% of South Sudanese women in a marriage or a union are using modern contraception in South Sudan, according to the government's household survey. That's compared to a prevalence of 60% in advanced countries. The lack of access to contraceptives, tied with the increasing prevalence of violence across the country, has encouraged the UN Population Fund to look at other ways to help with family planning in South Sudan.
But because also of the crisis, there is a high demand for making babies. The fertility here in South Sudan is at 6.7, which means every woman in reproductive age is expected to have a minimum of seven children. When you have that many children at a very younger age, you are exposed to the risk of death.
Hunton says religious, social, and cultural barriers discourage many women from getting help with family planning, and the UNFPA has only assisted about 1,300 women in South Sudan since the beginning of the year, which includes psychosocial services and dignity kits to ease the trauma of war. Issues like maintaining confidentiality and guaranteeing safe practices in their clinics make it difficult for health officials to treat patients.
Any country, very poor countries where education is low, we tend to have those barriers. For example, here in South Sudan, child marriage is very, very high. 40% of adolescent girls by the age 15 are already married off. So when you think about it, quite often when they are married, they drop out of school as well. They become pregnant. Their body is not even well prepared or ready to sustain pregnancy, so we have a lot of complications. They cannot pursue their dreams.
The UN Population Fund says 225 million women in developing countries want to avoid pregnancy but do not have access to safe family planning methods. Most of these women live in 69 of the poorest countries in the world, including South Sudan. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
And that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. For more on today's show and more on my interview with Melinda Gates, you can check us out on facebook.com/healthchatvoa. And you can also email us your question at healthchat@voanews.com. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Jackson Bungani and engineer Robert Wagner. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
What's up, Africa? I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America.
Listen, we need to discuss what's going on in your communities, issues that affect you.
Are you involved?
Are you engaged in transforming your society?
Today, right now, this is your platform.
Let us know what you've been up to.
Check us out on Facebook. Drop us a line.
It's Upfront Wednesdays at 17:30 UTC
right here on VOA Africa. Africa.